Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you're doing well. I'm Patrick Casey, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. Henrik and Lana are currently moving, so I'll be filling in for a few shows. Our guest for this show is Bill Marchand. Bill is the author of Northern Reaction, Notes from a Frozen Place. He writes about politics from a right-wing perspective at his blog, also titled Northern Reaction. In this show, we'll discuss his book, The Current State of Canada, right-wing activism, and much more. Welcome to Red Ice, Bill. Thank you for coming on the show. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing well. You?
Doing quite well. Thank you. So we've got a lot to get into here, and I think this is gonna be definitely a very interesting show. But before we get into the main topics, let's talk about you for a bit. Why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm Canadian. Most people probably know that who have heard of me. I live in a houseboat on James Bay. I'm active on Twitter. I used to be active on my blog, but I haven't posted anything in a while. And I like to talk about metapolitics and politics and history.
Yeah, those are topics that, Red Ice listeners are definitely very interested in as well. So why don't you tell us how you became involved in dissident politics to begin with?
Well, it all started, and this is kind of an old man story, but so it all started when I picked up an issue of Maclean's. Maclean's is a Canadian magazine, for those of you guys who don't know, and it's for the most part perfectly mainstream, but for a while there they had an author named Mark Stein write for them, and some of you guys may be familiar with Mark Stein. He is a frequent guest of like Rush Limbaugh and that kind of thing. And this issue of the magazine came out shortly after a shooting in École Polytechnique. So it was a school shooting. The school shooting, how it happened was a crazed gunman went into this university classroom, and he insisted that all of the men in the classroom leave the room. And then once all of the men were out, he shot all the women in the classroom. And it was horrible and horrifying and all of that. And what we kept hearing at the time was that this was an example of the toxic masculinity of Canadian culture. Now, this was many years ago, so they didn't use the term toxic masculinity, but that was generally what they were pointing at, that notion. And I picked up this magazine, and Mark Stein had a column about École Polytechnique. And Mark Stein agreed with the people saying that it was a problem with masculinity in Canadian culture that caused this shooting, but it wasn't the crazed gunman that had the problem that caused this shooting. That the crazed gunman was a crazed gunman. Crazed people are going to do crazy things. That the problem with masculinity in Canadian culture was all of the men that filed out of the room without putting up a fight. The men that did absolutely nothing when they had a very good idea that this person was going to massacre these women. They didn't do anything about it. And he said that was the problem with masculinity in Canadian culture, that there isn't any. And so that sort of, at the time, opened my eyes that what we were being fed could in fact be, the kind of narratives that we were being fed could be literally the exact opposite of the truth. Not just sort of skewed, a little bit off or anything, but the exact opposite of the truth. And that was sort of what started it, and I read all of his books, and kind of from there I developed my own way of thinking about things, and I disagree with him on a number of issues, but that for me was the beginning of dissident politics, of not agreeing with or not even giving the mainstream narrative the time of day if it doesn't deserve it.
Yeah, I had never heard of that that particular incident. That is very egregious. One term that Guillaume Fay has used, the French New Right author, is de-virilization, and I think that's a very apt term for a phenomenon that's happened not only in Canada but in the West overall. Men are not men as they used to be, and you can blame that on a number of factors. People generally point to things like you know, there's some combination of individualism, of comfort, of declining testosterone levels. I think there are definitely many culprits that we could attribute that to. But I think that the situation in Western countries wouldn't be nearly as bad if men did have a more masculine, a more heroic, mentality. But I never heard of that particular incident, and that is, it's very, very troubling to hear that it went down like that.
No, absolutely. I don't think that it is definitely a major issue, but there's plenty of people that will tell you all about that. Talk about the lack of masculinity in today's culture, and that's a point that most of the Red Ice listeners would kind of grasp, even if they don't know of this particular example, they could guess how it would go down.
Yeah, definitely. Well, is there a particular political label that you feel best describes you? Around these parts, people tend to use terms like nationalist, reactionary, identitarian. Do any of those apply to you?
Well, I have conflicting views on the term the alt-right. I have gone out of my way to ensure that I'm not labeled as a part of the alt-right. My go-to explanation is that the alt-right is an American movement, and as a Canadian, I'm not a part of it. Mm-hmm. But I think that is something that is beneficial to the alt-right, that it can be the boogeyman. It can be the thing hiding in the shadows that you're not really sure where its extents are and who is a part of it. And any individual that is confronted by that label saying, oh, you're evil because you're part of the alt-right, can retreat into, no, I'm a Southern nationalist, or no, I'm an identitarian, or whatever kind of label that you particularly go for. But I think it's useful in that way. But as for myself, I'm the closest to actual politics that I want to have is sort of this Carlylean politics, where I don't think that I or anyone who isn't much, much, much smarter than me should have any say in the way that politics run. That it's mind-blowing to me that I don't like tooting my own horn or anything like that, but I'm above average IQ. I would not want to run a country. I can't imagine like the mindset of the people that want people that are dumber than me, dumber than you, dumber than average, having a say in how a country is run. I don't get that. It should, in my personal view, it should be one person and possibly like advisors, experts in some subject that should be running the country, and anything else is just it's mind-blowing to me that it's popular. I don't understand it. Right. So somewhere around Carlylean reactionary.
Yeah, I think that if you have the right elite in charge, then having a highly authoritarian, for lack of a better term, regime can work out quite well. And you see that in China. Granted, the Chinese government isn't perfect, but they appear to be working towards the interests of the Chinese people and the Chinese nation overall, which is a bit of a foreign concept at this point. Here in the West, with Donald Trump coming along and saying, America first, that America should put its interests first. And that is, that has been compared to Hitler and isolationism that allowed, the Holocaust to happen and whatever else. But, then again, if you do have the wrong elite in place, then things can go quite poorly. But I do agree that if you had the proper elite in place, then, having them kind of take the lead would definitely be ideal.
Yeah, and like that's kind of the thing is that like there's other countries, like Liechtenstein has a monarchy that actually does things. Singapore is basically a monarchy, a monarchy where the previous person gets to choose the new one. And they're both very well run. I just, like, we can get someone like Donald Trump in and do things that are for the benefit of the people, but so often it's just dumb luck that the person who is best at campaigning is also best at governing. You know, that's kind right. of another one of the things that really weirds me out about democracy is that the system is built so that the people that are best at campaigning win, not the people that are best at governing, which kind of goes right. to Nicholas Taleb's skin in the game thing, that the in the old monarchies, if you didn't do a good job, the people would revolt and you would be killed, you know, or your mm-hmm. your children would inherit a kingdom that didn't run well, or that was poor, and then they'd get killed. So I really like the element of skin in the game in that kind of politics, as opposed to democracy, where the worst that'll happen is you make some good deals, you get some good money, and then the next guy has to clean up the mess.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the next guy, he has to clean up the mess, but he's also, you know, his primary motivation going in there is also to do the same thing that his predecessor did, which is, you know, enrich himself, kowtow to the powers that be and the deep state and the various financial interests and so forth, so that, you know, when he gets out, he'll be in a good situation.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very, you know, there are many things that can be said about democracy, but I think that that issue is particularly troubling. So you wrote a book titled Northern Reaction: Notes from a Frozen Place. Why don't you tell us what the book's about and what inspired you to write it?
Well, the book is mostly a collection of my blog posts. I run a blog, northernreaction.wordpress.com. And the impetus for the book and the blog posts was that Canada has oversized effect on the world, because the left sees Canada as this wonderful, darling, diverse place that can do no wrong, and the right sees Canada as this useless place that does nothing at all, or just only basically affects things within its own borders, and in those cases negatively. But so I kept seeing Canada being hated by the right for the wrong reasons. The big one, the one that kind of started it all for me, was Canada had a huge hand in destroying Rhodesia. When the issue of whether Rhodesia would become part of the British Commonwealth and be part of the world stage came about, there was a whole lot of discussion about that among the players at the time, and the Queen didn't really care. And the British Prime Minister didn't really care. They were both fine with telling Rhodesia, hey, you should give up apartheid. You should give the Africans the right to vote, all of that kind of stuff. But if you don't, it's fine. We're just going to keep doing what we're doing. It was the Canadian Prime Minister, Lester B. Pearson, who set up I don't remember the name of it. It has some weird acronym, but it was basically a document that he had everyone sign, the British Prime Minister and the Queen and all of the other key players sign, saying that Rhodesia would not be recognized on the world stage until they got rid of apartheid. And that was what caused all of the strife in Rhodesia, that they couldn't trade with anyone except for, I think it was South Africa and Israel. And they managed to survive for another 10 years or something like that. It was quite impressive, but still that was the beginning of the end for Rhodesia, where they were no longer a part of the world stage. They were being actively fought against by the communists to the north of them and to the east. I think it was the Zambios to the east of them. But anyway, that is what caused Rhodesia to become Zimbabwe. And you can lay a whole lot of the blame squarely on Canada, and no one knew that. So
interesting.
Part of what I wanted to do with the book and the blog was to let people know that Canada had a major impact on, has had a major impact on world politics for a variety of reasons, and that you can't really understand modern politics, especially multiculturalism, which is something that I talk about quite a bit in the book, without understanding Canadian politics and Canadian multiculturalism. So that was kind of my impetus for wanting to write these articles and write the book, was to get these ideas out there, get people to understand that a lot of the origins for these things came from Canada.
Well, I suppose I need to read your book then, because I'm pretty unaware of Canada's role in all of this. You know, we're here in America, we're familiar with Justin Trudeau and all of the signaling that he does, and it's kind of the state of free speech. So, you know, in Canada isn't as great as it is here, but I had no idea that Canada played a role in all of that in Rhodesia. So I'm not terribly surprising given, you know, Canada's ideological circumstances now. But so your main impetus for writing the book was to let people know the role that Canada has kind of played in world affairs. Is that just kind of in the past few decades?
Since the 1960s, the big two huge things that Canada has done to affect the world stage was the Rhodesia thing, which I argue in my book was kind of the end of the possibility of a successful post-colonial Africa. That if Rhodesia had stayed the course and had been able to slowly transition into something more, Stefan Molyneux talks about this, that in order to have the kinds of institutions that modern Western countries have, you need to have a middle class. You need to have people that are invested in the continuation of the status quo. And so the argument that I make in the book was that over many years, Rhodesia could have, at their own pace, developed a solid middle class and had that transition into something approaching what would be an acceptable democracy for the rest of the world, and everyone would have been fine. And then other African countries could have seen the kinds of things that they were doing, could have had a model for how they could govern themselves and possibly copy that and actually have a couple of functioning countries in Africa. So my argument there is that Canada ruined Africa, basically. And then the multiculturalism thing, the kind of multiculturalism that we see throughout the world is not American multiculturalism. I know that Moldbug at one point mentions that it's the Democrats in the States that are the kind of origin for a lot of the left-wing ideas in the rest of the world. But this particular one, this idea of multiculturalism, is 100% Canadian. The American idea of multiculturalism has always, or since they had an idea of multiculturalism as opposed to before, was the melting pot model, where everyone kind of comes together and exchanges things and becomes one whole. And I understand, I'm well aware of the drawbacks to that. I talk about them briefly in the book, but there are drawbacks to that, but it works much better than the Canadian model. The Canadian model is the salad bowl. That's where no one mixes. Everyone just keeps to the exact same thing that they came in with, their exact same culture, mm-hmm. and basically sets up enclaves. And the ideal of it is that they aren't enclaves as in groups of people, is that it's one, like one house is completely Hindu and is if you walk in the house, it's exactly like if you just walked into India, and then the next house over is exactly if you walked into China, and that kind of thing. But that's not how it happens. It just ends up being these ethnic enclaves where there's like a miniature city. Like every city has a Chinatown, every city has a Little India, every city has all of these things, and no one adopts the whatever the dominant culture's values are. No one adopts any of the traits of the dominant culture. And that is the kind of multiculturalism that we're seeing throughout the world. That's the kind of multiculturalism that we see in Sweden, in Britain, in France, in Germany, in all of these places. It's Canadian multiculturalism. And the kind of interesting thing with that is it worked in Canada until it became the official policy, that we originally had English and French and some natives kind of living together. And so we developed this system where the model was, I'm going to leave you alone, you leave me alone, we're going to keep doing our own thing, and we're going to agree on these core kind of values or ideas, this bare bones set of ideas that both sides can agree on, but we're going to be completely separate. We're not going to mix. That's not going to be how it works. And that worked really well when we had two sets, two to three. Like the natives are kind of a different story, but with the English and the French. And the problem was when Pierre Trudeau, Justin's father, gave us a bait and switch and said, no, it isn't that we have these two to three cultures that are completely separate and do their own thing. It's that all cultures are completely separate and get to do their own thing. And there is no underlying kind of social contract agreement involved in this. And that is, if you look at it's the weirdest thing. If you look at the Wikipedia page for multiculturalism, it has a big section on Canadian multiculturalism where it argues the exact same thing that I am, that it's the origin of, it was the first multiculturalist state, quote unquote. And that they're proud of it. They're proud of this idea that we've exported this, this weird necessary thing in Canada because of the English and the French way of living to the rest of the world where it was not necessary and is toxic. And I don't think that Americans really understand the kind of multiculturalism that places like Sweden and Britain and France and Germany and all of those places. I don't think that Americans really understand what they're dealing with, because they keep having this idea that it's a failing version of what America has been trying to do since whenever that melting pot play came out. They keep thinking that it's a failing version of that, when in fact it is a succeeding version of this horrifying thing that came out of Canada.
Well, I'm going to have to start blaming Canadians for the ills of the world because you've told me all this. That is very interesting. I think the term a sociologist or anthropologist would use is a parallel society. That's the model, whereby immigrants come in and they create their enclaves that exist parallel to society at large. It's not a good idea. I mean, I suppose in some circumstances with certain minority groups, it wouldn't be the end of the world. But when you have enough people coming in, and they're coming particularly from Islamic countries, then that definitely is an issue. Even Asian societies as well, because the Asians are, particularly the Chinese, are very market dominant. They're successful, so they're able to, when they keep their own identities, they're able to. They're able to advocate for their interests and succeed, but as a group, not as just, Canadians and so forth. But I think that Canadian model of things appears to be spreading to America, too. I graduated from college a few years ago, and I studied anthropology. I remember in a few anthropology classes, the subject of assimilation came up. And that was something that in high school that we were all taught, in history, in civics class and history class, that assimilation was part of America. Immigrants came here and they assimilated and everyone lived happily ever after. Now there are issues with that, obviously, but just a few years later, when I was in college, in anthropology, these Marxist anthropology professors would talk about assimilation as being racist. It's racist to assume, or rather to expect immigrants to learn English. It's racist to expect them to adopt the social and cultural norms and practices of Americans, obviously European Americans. And I think that it's really just leading to ethnic strife. It's leading to conflict, and it's leading to just the total breakdown of social cohesion, social capital. I'm sure you'd agree with that.
No, absolutely. And I think that the reason why America isn't, like, obviously you're right, the push is for this kind of salad bowl multiculturalism, that in America it would be racist to have them assimilate. There is a push for that now, but it's not as nearly as bad as Britain or France or Germany or Canada or any of these other places. And another argument that I make in my book is that is because you have your own kind of strain of the virus of multiculturalism that is fighting that one. You have your own, the melting pot thing is already there. And so they're kind of fighting it out. And the same is true of Singapore, that they have their own kind of multiculturalism. They have, I think it's four different ethnic groups that are just like a quarter each of the population, somewhere around there. And they don't anymore have the kind of ethnic strife that is happening in Britain and Germany and some other places in Europe. And it's because they found their own way to deal with it. They found their own method of fixing the problem. And same with Poland. I point out statistically, there are more Muslims in Poland than there are, as a percentage of the population, than there are in, I think it's Sweden. But you never, ever hear of Islamic attacks in Poland. It just doesn't happen. Versus Sweden, we hear about a new one like several per week, right? So Poland had its own, has developed its own method of dealing with these different ethnic groups. And every country's different. Switzerland is another example where they have their own method of dealing with these ethnic groups. And one of the big problems is, I think that it's John Derbyshire that talks about this all the time, is that you're trying to export ideas that work with a certain set of people. And this salad bowl idea worked with the British and French and natives in Canada. And it was not developed to work with French people and Muslim people and whatever other group in France. It just wasn't for that. So the Canadian strain of multiculturalism is sort of duking it out with the American strain and the Polish one and the Singaporean one, and we'll have to see kind of where that all goes.
Yeah, definitely. So you mentioned Mencius Moldbug earlier. Did his writings over at Unqualified Reservations play a large role in you developing your views?
Yeah, for somewhat. It's kind of complicated. As a young man, I read the Mark Stein article, and kind of independently, I from there read more and more old books and books by dissident thinkers and that kind of thing. And at some point, I don't remember how, but I was put on to Unqualified Reservations. Someone linked me to it somewhere. And I really enjoyed his writing style. I know that that's not a normal thing to do, that most people kind of try and get through the writing style in order to get to the content. But I really enjoyed his writing style. So I read the whole thing, all I don't know how many thousands of pages worth of blog posts it was, but I read all of them, and I quite enjoyed that. And then I read Nick Land's Xenosystems site, and a bunch of other kind of dissident thinkers like that. That was probably around 2015 that I started reading the online stuff, and then that those ones kind of brought me back to the really old books. Like one of my favorite books of all time is Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War. And so I credit Moldbug less with shaping my politics directly and more with putting me in the right path of just reading old things that no one reads anymore.
Interesting. Yeah, reading old books, I think, is one of the best things people can do who are either just developing these views, just coming to this, perhaps people listening to this just discovered Red Ice, or, you know, people who have had these views for quite some time. There are plenty of old books to be read, and I don't think anyone out there is going to read all of them before they die. So my goal is to read as many as possible before I die, and it's definitely a very daunting task.
Yeah, I was just speaking of that. That something weird happened today. I was reading something like The Illustrious Men by St. Jerome, and it's just him very briefly going over like one paragraph summary of the lives of people from St. Peter until whenever he was writing in, I think, 500-ish AD. And he would list like a dozen books that each of them had read or had, written, that each of these like 150 important people had written. And he's just gives the title of the book and a brief summary of what it's talking about. And most of those don't exist anymore. And I got this awful feeling that I'm never going to get to read this random book that sounds to be exactly like the kind of thing that I would enjoy reading, because it's gone. So I treasure the ones that we have left.
Absolutely. And, you know, thanks to the internet, a lot of these old books are available for free. And that's something that prior to a few decades ago, no one in humanity was able to, you know, enjoy. You had to go pick up a physical copy, but now you can just, if the book is old enough, it's available, you know, for free in the public domain, and you can just type its name into Google and, you know, find a PDF within a few seconds. So there's definitely no excuse to be poorly read in this stage of human history. Although it does seem that despite, you know, these technological advantages that we have, the one I just mentioned in particular, people seem to be less well-read than, you know, I don't want to say at any other point in history, because obviously there are points in history when, you know, only priests and aristocrats could read. But in the past few centuries, I think that there's, you know, people now are definitely far less well-read than in the past. And that can be attributed to many factors. I think, technology is kind of a double-bladed sword in the sense that while we do have access to all of these old books, we also have smartphones and, you know, Xbox and PlayStations and so forth. So people are, a little, perhaps a bit distracted.
No, absolutely. And I always worry about how much of that is our thinking that people are less well-read now is survivorship bias, that we know the kind of the kinds of things that people would read back in the day because of the things that they wrote. And the people that were writing back in the day were the most well-read of the people that were living back then. But then I think, well, no, my father knew Latin. Like he could just read Latin, and he didn't go to some fancy school or anything. That was just the normal thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, so he read, I don't know, the Invasion of Gaul, the Julius Caesar's book. He read that in Latin. And there is no one going to school right now younger than 30 that's read the Julius Caesar book in Latin, you know?
Right.
So no, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that there's something going on, and we're not reading as much as we should.
I think technology in the form of, you know, distractions like social media and video games and all that is a factor. But I think there's just been an overall dumbing down of society where people just aren't interested as much as they used to be. And that the discussion on that would is perhaps for another time, because that would be a very lengthy one. But on the subject of Latin, I will say that I took 2 years of Latin in high school, and then I switched schools, and the school that I switched to, which is actually far nicer, didn't offer Latin anymore. So I ended up having to learn Spanish. So that's my excuse. Perhaps if I didn't switch schools, I would be reading Julius Caesar's works in the original Latin. But we should take a break somewhat soon here. But before we do, I want to ask you a few more questions. So we've discussed the issues with democracy, the issue with multiculturalism, and the differences between Canadian and American multiculturalism. What are some other problems that you see the West currently facing?
Wow.
Let's narrow it down to some of the larger problems, or the more noteworthy problems.
I think that one of the big ones is there was a discussion recently where Francis Fukuyama on Twitter said that liberalism not having content is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And let's unpack that a little bit. Is the idea that liberalism is the compromise position between like far left, far right, theocracy, all of these kinds of things, that we're not going to decide on what is best. We're going to just find the bare minimum that we can agree on and then enforce that, and then let everyone do whatever they want. And he said, and has said in his books, that that's a good thing, that leads to less conflict, and that leads to greater harmony, and all of the kinds of things that people like Steve Pinker like to talk about, where there's no more war or whatever. But the issue I have with that is that people aren't striving for things anymore. They used to have these beliefs or have these things that they would believe in strongly, and they would be something outside of themselves. And so they would, at the bare minimum, be like striving for the idea of their family and the propagation of their genes and all of that kind of thing, at the bare minimum. And we've gotten to the point where it is the propagation of yourself that is all that matters, because that's all that anyone can actually agree to deep down. G.K. Chesterton had a name for this. It was Methuselahism. And he said that the little anecdote thing, he said that a soldier went to went to the recruiter, and the recruiter asked him what his religion was, and the recruiter or the soldier said that his religion was Methuselahism, and the recruiter had never heard of that, and no one had ever heard of that, and so he asked him what it was, and the soldier said, "Well, I want to live as long as I can, and I'll do whatever it takes to do that." Named after obviously the longest living character in the Bible, Methuselah. And that is kind of where we are with society, that we are trying to make ourselves comfortable, make ourselves not feel any pain, make ourselves not have to do anything difficult. And as a product of that, we get things like Islam that does not have that problem, does not just want to make itself more comfortable and that kind of thing, has external goals. And we are getting steamrolled by those kinds of ideologies. And I'm really worried that that kind of Islam is the tip of the iceberg, that we're going to get these strange ideologies that we haven't even heard of at this point or don't think of this way, and that they're going to steamroll through our comfort. And I don't have a solution for this, obviously. I wouldn't be here if I did. But I think that this is something that really needs to be thought about, is the idea that we aren't striving for things anymore. And by not striving for things, we are going to not be able to strive for things when the time comes to do that, when the survival of actually important things comes up, that we won't be able to get them to survive.
Yeah, that's a bit of a grim forecast, but I honestly can't. it's a realistic one, and I can't really disagree with it. There seems to be something about modernity that, at least in the West, that it makes it hard for people to have convictions about, particularly about things greater than themselves. I think that's part of the reason why organized religion is declining. I think that's part of the reason why people having really strong convictions about about politics is declining as well. I mean, I think there's a bit on the right, there's a bit of a tendency to misunderstand normies and how they see things. The average normie isn't like a crazy social justice warrior who is tweeting death to Donald Trump and picketing outside the White House all the time. The average normie, honestly, it goes along with some of the lukewarm progressive anti-racist ideas just because that's what everyone thinks, right? But they, from my experiences, they are pretty turned off by like the far left stuff that we find ourselves preoccupied with as much as the far right stuff. And I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that I don't know if it's not cool or it's just seen as being too much for people to have, really strong convictions about the way the direction that society should take, how people should behave, and so forth. And I think that's why you see things like libertarianism kind of being on the rise. Like there are many people we call the alt-right that are just, they call themselves libertarians, or cultural libertarianism was something that was big for a while. I don't think most of these people have really read like Mises or Rothbard and so forth. I think it's just kind of a anything goes, man, like that kind of mentality. But you're right. The West is in a crisis now, and it's only going to get worse. And when the time comes where people actually need to step up and do things, lest everything, fall apart for good, I think a lot of these people just don't have the constitution to really do that. I think they've just been raised in a society that is caters to their every need, where, you don't have to, as a man, you don't have to worry about getting into fights. You don't have to worry about becoming strong and defending yourself. Because obviously if you live in like the ghetto or something, yeah, you have to worry about that. But, back in the day, if you really wronged someone, they could, probably punch you in the face, maybe beat you up a little bit and cops wouldn't do anything, right? If you said something mean to their wife or you really, disrespected them in public, these kinds of things. But I guess what I'm getting at here is that, people have been, thanks to comfort, thanks to, affluence, people are just, they're used to not having to have convictions. And as you pointed out, that's a very disastrous mentality.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Awesome. So I have one last question I wanted to ask you before we go to our break here. So I know you mentioned you don't like political labels, but I think that you could be described as having somewhat reactionary views. So most reactionaries seem to believe that the Enlightenment was a total disaster. Would you agree with that, or do you think that perhaps some aspects of the Enlightenment were for the good?
I think that the problem stems from grouping the Enlightenment as one thing, that there were a bunch of things that went on in the Enlightenment that were good. Like I love Hobbes. I think that Hobbes has really great things to say about like international relations, that sort of thing, that hadn't really been said before, are probably part of the Enlightenment and are really useful in thinking about how states run. But there are also a whole lot of things in the Enlightenment, Rousseau, I'm looking at you, that have, I don't even know how to describe it. They've retarded our progress. They have stopped us from thinking properly. And they're these ideas that have become a part of the Western consciousness, and they've become kind of central to the way that we think about things. And they're just wrong. They're just absolutely wrong. I wouldn't even know where to start with this, but I don't think that anyone on the right would disagree that there are some ideas from Rousseau especially, but Locke and a number of the other thinkers, that they're just wrong and in ludicrous ways, and that we can show that we can do studies, and we can do the really, really simple example. Rousseau's idea that man is born free and everywhere he is chained. We know that when people are given an infinite number of choices, they are less likely to make a good decision than when they are given two or three choices. We have excellent data to say that when people are given too many choices, when people are given too much freedom, then they end up not using it properly. That people's brains are not wired to think that way, to have that much choice in, like, the cereal aisle. They will just pick whichever one's in front of them. They'll succumb to advertising. Whereas if they have two or three choices, then they will actually look at the things that are important and go through and see which one's the best deal for them, which whatever. So Rousseau's idea that we need to give more freedom, people need more freedom, and that society is limiting their freedom, and that's a bad thing, is just wrong. It's just demonstrably wrong. And there are so many examples of things from the Enlightenment that are like that, where we absolutely know that these things are wrong, but they're part of our consciousness. They're part of the way that the Western mind thinks today. And so it's difficult to get rid of them. And I think that one of the things to do is to no longer or to try to not address the Enlightenment as one thing. That there are elements to it that are really useful. I as I said, love Hobbes, love what he talks about with international relations, but we need to separate Hobbes's international relations with Rousseau's ideas about child rearing, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I've always seen the Enlightenment as being kind of a mixed bag. There are things you could point to and make arguments for them being good, and, you know, to the contrary, there are things that I think most of us on the right can admit that were not good things for the West on the long run. I think one of the biggest issues with the Enlightenment is the fact that now you have people, and when I say people, I mean literally only white people, who have fetishized these abstract Enlightenment ideals. They've, you know, they conceive of them as universals, even though they're things that, again, pretty much only white people care about. And now these white people care more about these values than they do themselves. There are many, you know, conservatives and perhaps even libertarians who they would rather have, you know, the Constitution live on and a society that worships the Constitution live on than, you know, a society of white people. Like, they'd rather America be 100% African as long as everyone's, you know, reading the Constitution and you know, reading John Locke and whatever else. Just because these ideas, you know, you have people like Glenn Beck that elevate the Constitution to the level of a religious document. It's all, it's almost cult-like to a certain extent.
But. Well, it very much is. It and the Declaration of Independence, and I say this as a somewhat reactionary Canadian, so I don't have to give any lip service to the Declaration or the Constitution. It is a religious document. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Why would we possibly hold those truths to be self-evident?
Right.
Like if it isn't a religious document, then it isn't anything. It's just fluff on paper. And that's fine. Have your religion. Do your thing. But what I was saying about the multiculturalism thing, is it was written for a specific set of people. It was a good mm-hmm. way of governing a specific set of people, and trying to get other people to be governed by that is not going to work well. Like Liberia. Liberia has the exact same constitution as the United States, and it is not having a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think early America, or, you know, for a while, America was a really good country. But when you have the founding documents just fetishizing the equality between men, you know, the nuance is like, oh, they only meant that for, you know, straight white property owners of European yeah. heritage, obviously.
Then Germans, maybe, like Franklin.
Right. Swedes, Italians, all a bit swarthy for, you know, Ben Franklin's liking. Yeah. But yeah, when you have, I mean, those little nuances are going to disappear as time goes on. And they also provide an opening for people to weaponize those terms against the native population. And that's exactly what we've seen. But let's go ahead and take a break here. We'll get more in the second hour. We'll get more into a discussion on the alt-right. We'll talk about a few articles that you have written on activism and so forth. I think that's going to be a good discussion. But before we do, why don't you tell the Red Ice listeners where they can find you on the internet?
So the two places to find me on the internet are northernreaction.wordpress.com. That's my website. Hasn't been updated in a while, but I'll probably be putting something on there in the next week or two. And then the place where I'm most active is Twitter. I am at bmarchant3. So that's Marchant, M-A-R-C-H-A-N-T. So yeah, that's where you can find me.
Excellent. And we'll also have a link to your book in the show description. So everyone listening should definitely head over to Amazon and check that out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Don't forget to buy my book. It's only $5.22.
There you go. Sounds like a good deal. All right. Well, we will wrap up here, and we'll pick back up in the second hour.